Blog Talk Radio.
Been running through me like you got somewhere to be. You're stuck in a full-time daydream. Always in a rush, I know you're busy for lunch. Taking pictures of your coffee.
Yes, we do. We all go running around and around and around. And now we're going to stop running around for a while, sit back and relax, and listen and enjoy the moment. Yes, this is our official band that provides all the music for Tippy Talk. He's Newborn. If you have not heard of them yet, you will, because they're on the brink of exploding into a world-renowned band. And if you want to hear more of the music, you can go to newbornband.com and enjoy the wonderful sound. And now it's time to step into the Sippy Zone, where we explore the other side of reality, the side that allows you to reshape your life, to step into your power, and to connect to the fact that we are all one. Welcome to Tippy Talk. My name is Tippy Feldenstein, and I am dedicated to explore a life that is lived with clarity, confidence, control, and awareness. Tippy Talk is where you go from where you are to where you want to be. And where we want to be today is right here on Tippy Talk, where we will be exploring one of the most important topics of the day, which is socialism. We will take a closer look at socialism with Patrick R. Colabella, who's the author of a book called How to Get Rid of Socialism and Solve the Fiscal Problems of the United States of America. We've all been looking and trying to figure out how to get rid of socialism. Well, you know what? Now you have the answer. He happens to be, in my opinion, overqualified to solve the fiscal problems we are experiencing, and we are experiencing tons of fiscal problems. Patrick R. Colabella is an associate professor of accounting and taxation at St. John's University. He understands our taxation system, which is a very complicated system that most people don't even begin to understand at all, even though everybody that is actually working pays taxes or risks going to jail. He served as a faculty advisor for Beta Alpha PSI for the last 19 years, and BAP is a National Honor Society of Information Professionals. He has also served as a committee chair of the NYSSCPAs, and he served in his profession as a peer reviewer for the Peer Review Quality Control Program of the AICPA. He has also served on several corporate boards, and these boards include banks and charter schools and several non-for-profit organizations. He's also a senior partner and semi-retired of the Colabella & Company LLP. He has published several articles in the CPA Journal as a tax professional and academic. And that is of a lifetime, and so I'm very excited, and I'd like to welcome Patrick Colabella to Tippy Talk. And thank you so much for joining us, Patrick.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. It is a great morning when we can begin to talk really, really important things that are now plaguing us in the United States, and that is socialism.
Oh, yeah. It's coming down to that, and I'm kind of happy to see the debate going where it's going. Finally, people are talking about socialism. Because of, I guess, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. It's important because back in the day, if you labeled Hillary Clinton, when horse running as a socialist. You got hush. You shouldn't do that. But socialism has come out of the closet, and it's come out of the closet after 8 years of Obama. And you know, I'm going to label him a socialist, and some people don't like that.
And before we start talking about all that, let's talk about you for a minute. You began your career a long time ago. Where did it start for you?
Well, it started in at Deloitte and then it was known as Haskins and Sells and Deloitte Plunder Haskins and Sells. Now, Deloitte, and it's a large accounting firm. It was, of course, post my graduation, of course, and I took a master's degree in taxation, and I taxation was my forte. So I learned a lot from that firm, and I left there and I went to the Equitable Life Assurance Society for a number of years, and I became the director of taxes of the holding company, so I knew a lot about, you know, taxation of insurance companies as well as the whole consolidations and whatnot. I moved from there, and I always wanted to start my own practice. So in 74, 79, about that period of time, I kind of gravitated into it, and I had an opportunity to leave Equitable and move into my own practice. And as a result of happenstance, I kind of stumbled upon teaching, and it was something I kind of avoided in my life, because the notion was those who can do, those who can't teach, and that's probably the biggest lie ever perpetrated on society. You could say that about politicians too. So those who can, do, those who can't become politicians. I think that's more true than the latter. But luckily got into St. John's, because I went to St. John's University. They knew of me, and I was able to get a tenure track position. And over a period of time, I acquired my doctorate. My doctorate's in education, I've been there ever since. So my firm has progressed.
In St. John's?
I beg your pardon?
In St. John's you've been ever since?
Yes. I haven't been in any other university. And my disdain for socialism arose from my teaching career and the things that I wrote, the scholarly things that I wrote and published. And those things happen to be not really anti-socialist, but when you took the conglomeration of all the things that I've written about, you start to see that, what's the underlying issue here? And the underlying issue in the Internal Revenue Code, you said, where did this come from? And this came from the progressive movement, early on in the late 19th century, early 20th century. And it was actually born or drafted as a redistribution scheme by Cordell Hull. Cordell Hull, was the architect of the Internal Revenue Code and the income tax as well as the estate tax. And then you start to see, how things have unfolded. And if you look at the history of, what has happened, in the early part of the 20th century, particularly with, from Woodrow Wilson on, from 1913 on, which is the start of the income tax, on to, post-World War II and now, you start to see the interrelationship or the interaction the mover being socialism, inside this movement, and it has moved up and it's moved down. The socialists have come to power and they're sort of going back into the woodwork, and now they're pretty much out of the woodwork. But the Trump election is actually putting them back into the woodwork, and they don't want to be there.
So basically what you're saying is that the beginning of the implementation of socialism in our society right here was done through the taxation.
Well, the beginning of socialism, you know, comes from a variety of of circumstances. It really comes from the post-Civil War, okay? And you got to understand it's an economic and political ideology, socialism. And you just go to the economic side. You know, the South had slaves, and they didn't pay for labor, okay? And of course, they sold the South sold their goods into a capitalist movement where they, of course, were making textiles, so to call them textile capitalists. And that's what you had.
So just to be clear, the slave owners were Democrats. I just want to be really clear about that because.
Well, yeah, that's true. That's very true. Without labeling them or whatever, this is what it was. But the whole thing about socialism comes from the fact that there was a post World War II. That anti-slavery's gone, okay, and there's a rise of the middle class, or really a gelling of what was the middle class. And middle class is labor, okay, and the labor side of things. And you, of course, had the farmers, okay, who are had to move their wares, their crops, you know, into society. And of course, you had the northern industrialists that controlled the railroads and of course the factories that made the machines and all this other stuff. So you do have this this gelling, okay, of a notion that the northern capitalists are thieves, and of course you've got this concept of robber barons. They were not robber barons; they worked for what they wanted. They were out of the freedom that this country gave them. They were able to formulate an industrial revolution, which we still are feeling the benefits of that. It's freedom that actually allows people to make things and to make things better in life, and that's really the whole thing about capitalism. It allows people to do that.
Right. I thought you said it's freedom that makes people socialists. So what is the Global Institute of Taxation? No, I said that.
Oh.
It's not true. What is the Global Institute of Taxation?
Well, I was looking for a better tax system. I've been doing tax returns, and I'm looking at this. I said, there has to be a better way. Okay, and I went to the Internet at the time, which is very young. And I found out that there were other ideas about taxation, which did not involve an income tax. And one was in Australia called the debit tax, and it was started by a guy by the name of Leonard Crisp. And St. John's University, good enough to afford, you know, its professors the ability to research things, and they sent me off to Australia, and I stayed there for a couple of weeks. And there was a movement going on at that point in time, which was trying to counteract the value-added tax, or the GST, they call it, and then this movement for the debit tax. And the debit tax was basically this. It was a very small tax that was electronically collected out of every bank debit, okay, that went through your bank account. And it was there to replace the income tax. In theory, it worked. It would work perfectly, but the way I saw it, it was not just every debit. And you know, I had a modification of it anyway. So you know, I went out there, I studied it. And a fellow there was Michael Gray, and I haven't seen him in years. But he said he developed a name for an institute, the Global Institute for Taxation. He called it GIFT. And when I came back to New York, there were people in the Republican Party who were dead set against sunsetting the Internal Revenue Code. And one was Congressman Steve Largent, you know, if you remember who Steve Largent was. Again, St. John's University allowed me the latitude to actually go and see him. And I did, and, you know, he was all for it. I developed this thing called the withdrawals tax. And the withdrawals tax is part of the book, two chapters in the book. And I lay all of this out, and I developed that with a colleague, Richard Coppinger. And so this is how things progress. And Steve Largent, we decided to have an international conference on fundamental tax reform in 1999, and we had it. And Peter Tobin, who is the as a namesake of the St. John's University, again had the belief in me that we could actually do something. We had this conference. It was then in a hotel in the World Trade Center, and that was really a conference which I didn't. Which was so successful, and I really wasn't able to capitalize on its success, because post that came 9/11, but we had a lot of people who showed up from all over the world to force their ideas about changing the tax code, and the thing about this is that there's a fundamental misconception that people have is that no tax in that governs any kind of government, it's inside any government other than an income tax, is practical. So every time you talk about a tax, you naturally go to income. And the problem with the income tax is income, because you have to determine this. Okay, when you have to determine income, you've got rules that determine income that really is accounting-based. And, of course, you've got generally accepted accounting principles, so on and so forth, to determine what is income and how you measure it. And of course, then you tax it. But the thing is, the problem that you have with the income tax is the rules behind determining income actually allow the government to socially engineer you, okay? And that is really, really the problem behind the income tax. And it's not efficient. It definitely is not efficient. We pay enormous sums of money in all taxing authorities, federal, state, and city, to collect the tax. And you don't have to do that anymore. We have the technology to actually collect the tax electronically, just like you have EasyPass. Like you go through the toll booth. Now you don't even have toll booths anymore. Okay, so you can go through and click. You have a payment. And the idea behind the withdrawals tax is just this. Okay. Okay, we have withdrawals from banks, and we can collect, say, I you pick a number, 5%, of your withdrawals, and those immediately go to a pool, and the pool gets distributed between the federal, state, and the city governments in some kind of rubric. Okay, so that's the detail of that is left to something later, but the practicality of it is that it's an electronic collected tax. There's no question about what it is, and you can't avoid it. You cannot avoid it. So in other words, it means you run your stuff through the bank. You have to pay it. Some people think this is
okay,
great.
So before we go into the income tax, mm-hmm. which is fascinating, like I said, because I've been paying income taxes since forever, but I don't really know exactly how they figure out how much. I know it's always a lot. But before we go into that, let's talk a little bit about socialism, because I love the way you start your book with a great question that everybody always gets asked. And it happens to be also that my daughter, when she started questioning why people were doing what they were doing, the thing that she said that they told her was, well, it's so wonderful in Holland, it's socialists, and it's just an amazing system, or the way you start your book is great. So what's wrong with socialism? They have it in Scandinavia, and they're all so happy. Why are you, what's wrong with it? So why don't we define, first of all, what is socialism to begin with? What does it even mean?
Okay, just by definition, it's an ideology. It's both political and economic, it advocates that the means of production, which is basically the thing what people make, and distribution, should be regulated by the community, okay, and basically redistributed. So basically, you don't really have control. You're going to make things, but there is a community which actually would redistribute that. And that is really the fundamental problem with socialism, but that's what it is.
So basically what you're saying is that every dollar that I make doesn't really belong to me, belongs to a community, and the community decides how I spend that dollar, or they
force
me.
You got it. That's basically it in the rawest of terms. In the rawest of terms, there are so many qualifiers that are put in front of the term socialism that there's a lot of confusion as to what it is. And nowadays people talk about democratic socialism. To me, that's just lipstick on a pig. It's really that bad.
I love that. How would you define it? Okay, so you're saying that socialism means that your money belongs to the community, and
right.
And so the community has the right to your money, obviously, because. So does that mean that you make money?
You don't assume that, because that's the premise, the underlying premise. The community doesn't have the right to it. I mean, if you go back to
socialism, they do.
According to socialism, yes, they do. And so the people who took the risk and spent the and do the hard work to actually create the wealth, okay. Are basically swept aside and say, well, now you created this for us. Now we're elected, okay, and we're the community, and we can take what you've made for yourself, and we can redistribute it. And that's not just at all. I mean, if you go back to the days of the Greek philosophers here, and Plato, he says justice is having. And doing of what is one's own, okay? So, socialism has evolved, okay, into something which is completely, completely unjust. I mean, philosophers are probably chomping at the bit when I say that, but that's the way I'm perceiving it. That's the way I'm laying this out, that the way socialism purports to be just or justice. They can talk. It's born out of social justice.
Right.
Another crazy term. Okay, but why is there a qualifier in front of the word justice? Justice is justice, and to me, justice is truth. Okay, and I went to Xaverian High School in Brooklyn, and the thing I still remember is walking up there the first day, and across the top of the entryway says, "The truth shall make you free." And that's important, okay? That's really important. And truth is really the most important thing in life. No, it's still there. Proudly there,
So what's the difference between socialism and communism?
Socialism has this supposed democratic interplay, okay, where you do have the community trying to make decisions. It's inside a socialism operates inside a republic. Communism is just the full blown socialist ideology. In other words, you're just part of the cog in the wheel. You just make this and you just do that, and then we take everything. And there's a larger cadre of intelligence that decides, how to live. So basically you're living in a community, a commune, and that's what it is in a large scale. And there's no sense of ownership. There's no ingenuity. There's no enthusiasm. There's nothing that comes from that. It's just you can go back to the 1950s and look at the and I do refer to this in the book, some of the communist newsreels and shows, how good communism is. Well, if it was so good, it wouldn't have failed. I mean, it's failed every place it's been. And you might say it hasn't failed in China, but the thing is, there's a reason why. It's not really full-blown communism in China. It's a little different, a lot different, because it comes from the society that the Chinese have wrought over the years of many rulers, which are benevolent rulers, and this is the mindset of the Asians in history. I mean, that's part of it, because they could actually abdicate themselves to a larger thought process are larger, well, an emperor, so to speak.
Well, isn't
so,
it illegal
but
in China
other countries, that's
more,
not the case.
Isn't it illegal in China to have more than one child? I mean, how much more control?
Yeah, well, that's why you have a lot of Chinese immigrants coming to this country. I have numerous Chinese students in my at St. John's University. They're wonderful people, and they're very hardworking people, and they love their families, and it's a good thing to see. I don't know what the mindset of Mao Zedong and the whole communist movement in China. It was probably born out of some kind of practicality. We have too many people. We could let so many people starve. I mean, somebody made that decision, okay? And I think he did make that decision. And so there was a...
And so the question is it inevitable that socialism will always lead to communism? Is it something that really cannot
be
stopped?
If it's left unchecked, sure. And that's pretty bad. And I think... what you're seeing from the socialists now is the fact that they're trying to move into this this thing about democratic socialism. They're saying, okay, socialism, we know socialism is bad, but if we put democracy in front of it and we allow people to vote on these socialist policies and stuff like that, then it's okay. But it's not okay because what happens is that who you are putting in power, okay, is really, really important. And what socialism leads to is a ruling class, and a ruling class happens to just gravitate towards dictatorship and authoritarianism. That's what happens.
So that's inevitable. So basically, when Obama said when he got elected that he wants to redistribute the wealth, he meant that he wants to have a socialist economy.
You're damn right. That's right. And he's it gave me chills when he said that. He wanted to reconstruct America, and he made a lot of if it did anything successfully, that's what he did. You could see that in the Affordable Care Act. You could see that in the demise of the American automobile industry. And what he did to General Motors and what General Motors did to itself, I mean, is just abominable. I mean, think about it. What he did was, okay, they went bankrupt, and there's federal laws on the bankruptcy. But when and he put his nose into that, okay, and put the unions in front of the bondholders, and that was that's a total sin. You just don't do that. And that was purely socialist, and he ruined General Motors. And you know, I am a General Motors guy myself. I'm a car guy, and I'm a Pontiac man. And Pontiacs are not made anymore. Pontiacs, Saturns, Hummers, Oldsmobiles—they're not made anymore. It's the demise of a great automobile company, and socialism. Socialism actually kind of killed Jaguar back in the day. It's coming back. But think about this. They tell you in Scandinavia how wonderful socialism is, but the two Scandinavian
right.
car models, Volvo and Saab, okay, Saab is no more, okay, and Volvo was bought by Ford or whatever. So here, 7 million Scandinavian people, which is basically the size of New York, and they say, well, everything's wonderful in Scandinavia. It's not, okay? They with that many people, you can get away with, it's basically a large commune. You can get away with things. So supposedly everybody's happy. No, they're not. Okay, go on the internet and try to and see what people are saying. If you go on my books page, I did publish a few things about people who are not so happy with Scandinavia. But people will come out with, oh, this is a poll, and everybody's happy in Scandinavia. Well, you just look around the world, okay? I mean, I could start with Argentina, Venezuela, Greece, okay? All these countries where, socialism has caused it to fail. And I think the biggest one, okay, that you could study is Argentina, one of the most rich countries in the entire Western Hemisphere, just went by the boards because of socialism. Look at Venezuela. I mean, rampant riots in the street. No food, no nothing. I mean, it's horrible.
And you attribute that, and you attribute that to the fact that they became socialists and slowly took over everything.
Right, and the government, look, the government can't do anything right. Okay, you leave it to the government will screw it up. It's just that way. Look at it this way. Health care, right? The Affordable Care Act. What do they really want? The Democrats, sold you a bill of goods on the Affordable Care Act, which was a lie. They knew this thing was going to fail, but they never figured on Trump coming in the middle of this. Okay, what Obama wanted to do was have a single-payer system, which is total socialism, okay? In other words, they want to control all your health care. And they're chomping at the bit here because, you know, it's going to be totally upset by Trump. If you had Hillary Clinton coming in on this, I mean, you are moving more and more to total socialism. And the Affordable Care Act is it. And if you notice, you can notice that the Affordable Care Act enforcement has run through the Internal Revenue Code and run through the tax system. What's even more telling is that you have the government, okay, the Supreme Court, rather, saying that in their decision that the penalty for not buying insurance, okay, is a tax.
Yeah,
okay,
that was kind of confusing
to me.
I didn't understand that. Yeah,
sorry,
I didn't understand that battle because I remember there was some kind of a battle about the penalties, and then they took it to court, and then they labeled it a tax, and that made it okay. So that
right.
was a little
yeah,
bit
but you
confusing.
See, but you see now,
what was
this
it?
Is this is the pivot. This is the pivot right here, okay? I say that the tax system, okay, and the government's power to tax is the cornerstone of socialism. So if you did not have the power to tax, the way the Roberts looked at it, and I've been spending my life in Supreme Court decisions, believe me, then you would not have this, that you could not enforce the Affordable Care Act if you didn't have the income tax system. Just turn the clock back to Franklin Roosevelt and Social Security, the Economic Security Act that gave you Social Security and so on and so forth. I'm not advocating the end of Social Security by any means, okay? It's a great thing, but the socialists screwed it up. The FICA tax is considered a tax, but it's not. Basically, it's a contribution to a single-payer pension plan. That's all it is.
So how would society do anything if they didn't have taxes? I mean, how else can they?
Well, I'm not advocating that because society doesn't have taxes. It's how you tax people that's important.
Oh, okay.
If we're talking about a tax which is okay, you need X dollars, okay, to run the government, and you can get this money by nowadays, okay, which with an automatic tax collection system, which I advocate. But prior to that, you can get it by what we call value-added taxes. Value-added taxes are all over the world. And value-added tax is basically a tax. Value-added taxes. People don't understand taxation, and they want to keep it that way. They want to keep you dumb. They really do. My own little statistic was 95% of people didn't understand taxation. It's more like 99% of people don't understand taxation.
I don't know anybody that does understand it unless even the people that are doing taxes don't understand it.
Because they have a computer.
They mess it up. So value-added tax.
Well, a value-added tax is – well, can I explain that? It's important to understand that what the countries around the world have done is they have two taxes. They have the income tax is one and the value-added tax. Basically, it's as someone adds – it's like a sales tax. So as someone adds value to a particular product along the production line – so, in other words, somebody would make an engine. Engine would go to the manufacturer, would put in a car. And when he made the engine, okay, added value to the parts
to the metal,
engine, there would be a tax on that. And that moves forward. So, if you made the engine and it costs $2,000 to make the engine, and the evaluated tax was 10%, it would be $2,200 to the next stage of production. And it would be accounted for, okay, along the way until you've reached the end product. Now, this raises enormous sums of money,
Right, right.
And my withdrawals tax actually functions in the same way, but without the accounting. So, I tout the withdrawals tax as being the only tax that you can actually budget. But the enormous problem with with the value added tax around the world is the fact that they have this tax. It makes money, and they keep an income tax. You say, well, why do they keep an income tax? In Australia, they say, well, that's the only way we can control the people. And that is essentially what you've got. The income tax actually circumventing the constitutional function in controlling people. Think about this. Think about everything that you do. I mean, and here's all, students are out there and they're sheltered from this. And this is really the problem because they haven't experienced the world yet. They haven't started paying taxes. And I see them before they go out there. And I tell them, that this is what you're going to experience. When you start to write checks, the hardest checks you're going to have to write is to the Internal Revenue Service. So I had a kid in my class, Billy, if you're out there, I'm going to talk to you about it. And he was an advocate of Occupy New York. Okay, you're an advocate of Occupy New York, and of course the big companies were mean and all this
evil
sort of stuff.
Evil,
yeah, and this is what they're portraying. Meanwhile, he's on his cell phone. But anyway, but after he graduated, Billy kept in touch with me, and he wanted to do and he asked me to do his tax return, and then he got involved in a variety of, he started working in his career. And then he started to see, okay, well, what's this FICA tax coming out of my cell? What's this? How come they take so much in tax? What's federal, state, and city? What's this other thing? What's this other thing? You just open up your cell bill and you look at tax after tax after tax after tax.
Mm-hmm.
And you start seeing, oh, hey, something is going on here. And Billy happens to be one of the largest advocates of me as an accountant to do his friend's tax returns. So it's kind of funny, isn't it? Really, it's when students are out there and they can't really see the evils of socialism until they start experiencing that.
Right. That's, until it's your money on the line. When it's other people's money, then, well, right. Yeah, they have money. They should spend it. But when it's your money, then it's like, wait a minute,
well,
I worked for this.
You know what they say about it? Socialism is fine until they run out of other people's money. That was Margaret Thatcher's line. So eventually you run out of other people's money. And the fatal flaw of socialism is that wealth merely exists and it's there for the taking, and it's not because eventually
it doesn't exist. People
eventually
actually
the whole motivation for wealth goes away. And I teach taxation, and I come into my class and I'm saying, I'm here to poison your political minds, okay? Because I can't teach you accounting, okay? And I can't teach you about a company operating in a free market system where you are going to have, you're going to manage profits, okay? When, if you're a socialist, profits don't mean anything. Profits should be generated, but then again, eventually profits go away because all you do is make and give, and so there's no profit in the middle of that, you see?
And so
that's
you stop
the
working,
point.
Basically.
Right. The whole profit motive dies, and that's really how socialism dies. Terrible.
People say, well, you know what, if I'm going to work really hard for $1 mm-hmm. and you're going to take away my dollar and give it to somebody else, why don't I just stop mm-hmm. working and let somebody else do it and I can take their money away?
You
rather
got
than
it.
You taking my money away. That's how is that how the Soviet Union collapsed, basically, because nobody wanted to do anything anymore?
Well, variety of reasons why it collapsed, because they couldn't build the wealth it took to actually become a stronger country. I mean, look at this. Look at North Korea. Where does all what they make go? What does it go into? It goes into that lunatic's, nuclear system.
Right.
And this is what happened in Russia, because the Cold War was won, but Reagan outproduced the Soviet Union. We made things better and more precise and more dangerous, okay, if you want a lack of a better term, in terms of defense, than Russia could ever make. And it's still that way. And of course, that's how we won World War II. The only difference is that the Germans, we outproduced the Germans. Okay, we outproduced them. We had a military production. The production that we had made more tanks than the Germans can handle. And that's what happened. But actually, World War I, World War II, came from the ability of America to produce the things it produced to actually win that war. But you'll find that socialists today tell you that there's a list someplace on the internet, 75 ways that that socialism has benefited society. I read that and it was a total laugh. It's amazing. And they go down the list, okay, of 75 things, and everything that attacks dollar bills, was supposedly coming from socialism. So that proves my point in a way, because the thing is, I want to tell you that the tax system is the cornerstone of socialism. That's the way it all works. But it's not the fact that taxes paid for things. It's the fact of what you paid it, what you used the taxes for. One of the most telling things is the Social Security system. And the Social Security system is a quote-unquote Ponzi system, Ponzi scheme, and I'll argue with anybody who wants to tell me differently. And basically it was set up like this. Okay, we want to take care of people in their old age. Okay, we're going to sell you on the fact that you're going to contribute into this fund. Okay? Then what's going to happen is more people are going to come in afterwards, okay, and contribute to the fund. And because there's always more people coming in and people die off, right, then there's always going to be money into the fund, okay? Did they think about investing the money that was there? No, not at all.
What did
okay?
they do with the money? What did they
well,
do with
the
money?
Well, it's supposed to stay there, and it's static. But they'll tell you that it earns interest, and this is more than telling on this. They tell you that Social Security is now it's solvent to 2025. That's a lie. And what you've got here is a fund, okay, that started to build up from the 30s on up to the 60s, and we were fighting a war in Vietnam. Lyndon Johnson decided, well, I need money. Where am I going to get it from? And so they started to their mouth was watering, and they started to grasp onto the Social Security Fund. They borrowed from the Social Security Fund, $2.7 trillion. It's still an outstanding
borrowed.
Debt.
Mm-hmm.
Supposedly borrowed. If you think that they're ever going to pay $2.7 trillion back to that fund, you believe in purple elephants, okay? It's just not going to
yes,
happen.
Yes, how exactly are they going to do it?
They're not. But you see what happens is if you look, and it's in my book, okay, if you look at the structure, it's $110 or $100 billion coming a year as interest on the debt. So the actual interest of $2.7 trillion is being added to the $20 trillion that you have of debt out there. It's mind-boggling. Aside from that, and then you had the Clinton era that had some tax reform, and they said, oh, well, we have to start taxing Social Security benefits. Did you realize that? That if at a certain point in time, okay, in your income, very easily you fall into this tax. The 85% of your Social Security is subject to income tax. It doesn't take long to get there. Let's put it that way. Over 25,000 of income, 45 if you're married, so on and so forth. So you got this tax on Social Security. So $30 billion of tax on Social Security is added to the fund. So you have the $110 billion and the $30 billion. That's what brings it over the top. And that's what they're counting on for the to 2025. The system can't support itself without those things. So it's complicated. So but I address this stuff in the book.
Yeah. So you say that something needs to be done about it, and you have the solution that you talk about in the book, where we start with defining socialism.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, about the tax. The tax code basically is your specialty. That's where you have been years and years and years and years.
Well, there's four things in the book that really are that I address, and the tax code is I spend two chapters on that, and one I spend on the shadow economy, and which is the underground economy, the national debt, and of course Social Security. So those four things are the elements that were the downside of what socialism has left this country into. There was no national debt until after you had an income tax system, and the first World War and Woodrow Wilson. So the issue of the national debt, and of course. Spending money is really important, and people tell you, well, the income tax has to stay because it generates a lot of money. Well, if it generates a lot of money or enough money, how come you still owe $20 trillion? Doesn't make sense.
And it grows every year. It's not like it goes.
And it
down.
Grows every year. They keep spending more than they take in.
Yeah, so the taxation doesn't really work. So in the book, you say a brief history of taxation,
mm-hmm.
and historically, any person or group of people, and I'm reading directly from the book, who has come to power has sought ways to impose an all too often parasitic extraction of the wealth under the guise of fiscal policy or
right.
a security need. So this is not something new. The people have always been taxed to death by whoever the ruler the
mm-hmm.
rulership was, whether it was a king or a government or a republic or whatever.
Yeah,
Just
remember, this country was born out of a tax revolt. And the taxation system that was in place by King George was essentially a punitive type of tax system. And the rebellion came right out of the tax system. It's not that not people don't want to pay taxes. It's not an issue of money. It's an issue of freedom. The tax revolts, which is the American Revolution, came from the fact that the Americans said, we want to determine what our taxes are, not you, King George, thousands and thousands of miles away. So that was really how it was born. It's talking taxation without representation. So now you have to look at, after the Revolutionary War, how they set up the tax system. And the income tax was never set up from 1780-something to now, to 1913. And the government operated pretty well, you know, without it. And then, of course, the late 19th century movement into progressivism, which is just another euphemism for socialism, bore this system out. That's been the problem. So taxes are not really the issue. Taxes, the amount of taxes people pay. People understand that we need police, we need fire, we need this, we need that, and they're willing to pay for it. But what happens is the tax system disguises these things, and people don't know what they're paying for. Look at your phone bill. Look at your bill. Look at how many taxes are in there that are disguised as part of your cell phone bill. I know.
I just got a new service with Verizon, and I looked at the bill, and I actually called them up and said, what's that? Oh, that's a tax, a federal tax. And what's that? Oh, that's a city tax. And what's that? Oh, that's another tax that everybody gets all across the United States. Why? Because it's a Verizon tax. I mean, I would say 49% of the bill looked like it was taxes. And it's another thing. What about what happens to the money you pay? Who has control over and who really has any kind of accountability of what happens to the dollar once it's taken out of your pocket? Is there any accountability?
This is key because it's because a socialist, the basis is redistribution of wealth. Okay? What they have done is through the income tax system, they're able to grab on to your wealth. Okay, and they're very good at doing that. Okay, but actually redistributing it, they're not so good at that. It really doesn't get redistributed to where you want it. It actually finds its way to other politically favorable factions of socialism. And I got to tell you that, you know, maybe it's the subject of my next book. Here you've got President Obama, okay, spent $7.5 trillion, okay, on what? What did they spend it on? Where did it go? To me, okay, and I think, this is a theory, okay, that the $7.5 trillion went to supposedly subsidizing various businesses. A lot of people got paid, a lot of people got rich, but a lot of people, forked over a lot of money to the political parties. So I think that whole $7.5 trillion was basically a laundering of political contributions. In the end, I may be wrong, okay, but
research it. There's no accountability, and there's nobody that can go and seize those funds and show that it was transferred from A to B or from one place to the other.
Right.
That's
the scuttlebutt is that the people who made out on this were the unions. And, of course, if you just look at General Motors and the United Auto Workers Union, ruined the American automobile industry. And the union itself and the union workers were put before, the bondholders. Now, bondholders are people just like anybody else. But the thing is, here's this, labor movement that actually circumvented the bankruptcy laws. And this is just part and parcel of what happened to it. Happened to the $7.5 trillion. I don't know where the hell that went. Nobody really talks about it, and of course they don't want to talk about it. But I got to tell you, it certainly didn't go, back to supposedly poor people.
It didn't go in my pocket, that's for sure.
Lyndon Johnson said he had, he's going to fight the war on poverty. Nobody told him that he lost it. And still in all, no matter what you do, there are poor people. And the fact of the matter is that the socialists play on your charity, so to speak, and the fact that you should be taking care of people who are less fortunate. Well, if you've taken care of people who are less fortunate, then they're no longer less fortunate. And then what do you do with that? Do they really reach an equilibrium, or are you just dumping the money away? And the truth is, you just dump the money away because nobody's got any incentive to work. And I can tell you, that I have done thousands of tax returns, and I can tell you that the tax system has actually transformed the entire paradigm of American life. And I'll tell you how. People don't understand that there's four tax filing statuses. Married filing separately, single, and unmarried head of household. Now, the idea behind married filing separately was the fact that hubby went out to work, and wifey stayed home taking care of the kids. And it was the cheapest rate of income tax with the notion that there would be some kind of a partnership there, and it would foster the atomic family, and the atomic family's husband, wife, two kids, right? So now, as things progressed, people saw the income tax system as a way to be a low-level welfare program. And you've got the earned income credit, the child tax credit, you've got all this other stuff.
Right.
And what people do is, and they've used the system to do this, they come in, supposedly they're married or they're not married, okay? And they come in, but they never got married, but they're still living together. They have kids. What happens to the kids? The kids were latched on to the person who does not have any income. They get welfare.
Oh.
They get the child tax credits. They get all the stuff. And hubby, who was out, you know, making money, he's just paying tax on his, you know, his salary. When there are too many kids float into the kids get given to grandma. Grandma has no money. Okay, she gets welfare. And yet I've seen it so that a woman who is an older woman who is you know, taking care of grandchildren could get up to like $150,000 a year to doing nothing. Okay, but this is what's happening there. So they're gaming the system.
$150,000 a year? How is that possible?
The theoretically you can get that there, and I'm sure I've seen people come into my office where people are making under a certain dollar amount of money, having a couple of kids, they may be collecting welfare, but they don't make enough money to supposedly on paper, and they wind up getting the earned income credits for these kids.
Oh, okay.
And you wind up, people walk out of here with $8,000. Not they're walking out of my office with it. No, they're walking out of, the government is actually electronically giving that to them within 10 days, of course. Boom, 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 that's it. Okay. and this is can't, you can't believe, and I challenge anybody out there, okay, to tell me the extent of the fraud that goes on in the earned income tax credit area. It's enormous. And they actually have it in the system that says, oh, well, we checked everybody and we agree. And that's what they're forcing it on tax preparers, that, we looked at it, you know, and they qualify for the earned income tax credit. Do you know things that we don't know, so to speak? Terrible. Actually terrible. The income tax system has to go.
Yeah, it sounds like a really complicated way to very simply rip off people.
Yes, okay, and it's essentially what's happening is that you're ripping off the government. You're ripping money out of the government. That's why you got $20 trillion worth of debt. And I address the issue of the debt in the book, and that is one of the most important aspects of the book. How do you pay this back? You never pay it back. You can't pay back $20 trillion when you generate $4 trillion a year to run the government. After you get through with running the government and you pay, now you spend more than the $4 trillion to actually run the government, you're actually adding to the debt. You never pay it off. So how do you deal with this? And
Eventually something's got to give. So we have a lot of questions still, and we're running out of time. And what we're going to have to do is we're going to have you come back and continue this discussion, because this book has so much important information that every American needs to really understand.
Thank you.
I don't think anybody will ever understand the tax system or what it really is, but if we can simplify it for people to really get the idea of what they're paying for and why and what is done with that money and why, then maybe we can get some kind of comprehension. I think education is a great first step. So
yes.
To start the process, I would suggest that you go to – do you have your book on Amazon?
Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Okay, you can get it there. You can get it in what is it? The electronic book.
They have Nooks and all that. So
whatever
the name
they call
of the
that.
Book is How to Get Rid of Socialism.
Right.
And I guess all you'll have to do is go to Amazon if you want an e-book by Dr. Patrick R. Colabella. If you type in the word Colabella, Colabella, you'll get the list of a few books. And this book is great. It's got a flag of the United States on the cover. And it's called How to Get Rid of Socialism and Solve the Fiscal Problems of the United States of America. Solving the fiscal problems of the United States of America is not as difficult as you would think it is, because if you read this book, you would realize that it could be a lot simpler than you think. And one of those things is to stop allowing people to rip off the system. And it's It's not as difficult. It's not as difficult as people think it is. So for now, before we continue, I suggest if you're listening and you're interested and you really want to know what's going on, which you really should know, especially if you graduated college and you're really confused about what's going on, because that's what our universities do today. If you pick up this book, it will clarify so many things. So, you can also go to my website, which is tippytalk.net, and I will post it for you, the link to this book, if you want to get it. Or you can email me at thetippytalkshow@gmail.com if you have any questions or any comments or any follow-up that you would like, because we will be talking again. So if you want to submit any questions or anything that you want to have clarified, I know I do. I want to have a lot of things clarified. I don't really understand taxation, as a matter of fact. You can do my taxes because I don't have a clue how to do it.
Well, I'd be glad to. Tippy, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to talk about this. I appreciate it. I really do.
I am totally with you, and I love my country, and I definitely want to see it better and successful again and thriving again. And if this is what it takes, then this is what we're going to have to do. We have Trump in the White House, so that means that things might actually happen. I'm really excited also that you are going to Washington to talk to them about it, and that is really exciting. And we could talk about what happened when you went, when we return. And so for now, it is time to say goodbye. We've come to the end of our time together here. Thank you so much for joining us and giving us all this amazing information. And we will talk to you soon. I will let everybody know when we're going to talk. And until then, have a magical journey.
Thank you, Tippy. Have a good day, everybody. Bye-bye.
My